Archaeology is often practiced more than once in a particular place. As the skills and technology of the field improve, it pays to return to sites to see what more can be found about events that took place there. Our Underground History segment is all about archaeology. Our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, alert us to important trends and events and people digging in the ground to find out more about history. This month we hear about a project from SULA itself. Mark Tveskov is the director of SULA, and his team spent part of this summer exploring the site of the Battle of Big Bend, the final battle in the so-called Rogue Indian War of the 1850s. Since Dr. Tveskov is now on sabbatical, he joins us by phone from Connecticut. Hi, Mark.
How's it going?
Doing well. So obviously the significance of this is the final battle in the Rogue Indian War of the 1850s. Why was it fought there? What were the circumstances that led up to it?
Well, if you're familiar with the geography, that's a very inaccessible place in the Rogue River Canyon. And by the end of the war, the indigenous forces had basically been cornered in that inaccessible place, and they were using it as a fortress. So that's where they kind of made their final stand, as from a military point of view.
So there were some tactical advantages to that, the remoteness of the place?
Yeah. I mean, there were no roads. I mean, even in the best of conditions, there were no wagon roads along the coast, and even today there's no roads that go in there, so they were as inaccessible as they could be and easily defended.
What can be seen there now to eyes not trained like yours? I mean, if anybody were just sort of ambling past the site on a hike, would they have any idea what had happened there?
No. It's a wooded hill overlooking a beautiful stretch of the Rogue River that dozens of people raft by every week.
And so really no signs there. How many times have you dug there in the past, Mark?
This was my first time there. My first time conducting work there, and I visited the site once before.
All right. So, but there had been previous digs there, hadn't there?
Yeah. Back in the 90s, one of our colleagues, Jeff Applin, who is a resident of Southern Oregon, he got his master's degree from Oregon State University, and he had done some work with the Forest Service, an archaeological survey of the battlefield site.
I did read some of his work, and what did he set out to do, and what did he find?
Well, he, like a lot of us, was inspired by the research that had taken place at the Battle of Little Bighorn site, where archaeologists had used metal detectors and a systematic scientific approach to examine forensically a battlefield site and look at the distribution of ammunition, fired ammunition, and the like to augment the written record and oral histories of the project of an event to get a better sense of what actually happened there.
So the metal detectors were the new wrinkle that hadn't been done out there previously?
Not just metal detectors, but employing them in a systematic way as opposed to just doing what hobbyists often do, which is just go for the best spots where they know they're going to get a lot of things. We spend a lot of time walking straight lines in areas where there are no artifacts to just make sure we cover every corner.
So you mark it off like a grid in essence and then
just work
it like that. Yeah, okay. So how did the work that you were doing out there this summer differ from what Jeff Applin did in 1997?
Well, it augmented it and complemented it. We surveyed a wider area. We hit some corners that they hadn't got to, and then we also were able to bring to bear a lot more documentary research that we had been doing that gave greater context to the battle. And then the third thing is that we were able to employ geographic information systems technology, like the computer mapping that was unavailable or just in its infancy back then, which will allow us to place the artifacts on the ground with much greater precision. And we were able to incorporate, they did a great job with the technology they had, and we were able to use their results, too, and incorporate it into this project we're doing now.
So the GIS allows you to say specifically, in this very spot on this map is where we found Artifact X?
That's right, down to less than, say, 40 centimeters accuracy, about a foot.
Wow. Mark Tveskov, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and our partner on Underground History. This is our Underground History segment. We're talking about the dig this summer at the Battle of Big Bend, May 27th and 28th in 1856, the final battle of what has come to be known as the Rogue Indian War. Your questions and comments are welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Over the course of doing Underground History with you, I've learned learned how much you will spend time going through old documents. You just mentioned the documentary research that that was part of what the dig was at the Battle of Big Bend. What kinds That's of right. documents did you go looking for, and what'd you get?
Well, there are the official records of the United States Army, which had been known for a long time, and Jeff Applin had used those. In addition, our colleague Ben Truey at the Historical Society and myself have uncovered lots more newspaper accounts and memoirs and diaries of some of the participants that have fleshed out some of that story.
That must be a tricky business, though, because, newspaper accounts, it's often been said journalists write the first draft of history. It's often a rough draft, a very rough draft. So between the inaccuracies of people who weren't there and the people who might have had the stories grow over time in their diaries, how do you know what to keep in and what to take with a grain of salt?
Well, that's what we do. If you recall, we did that earlier project at the Battle of Hungry Hill, which the U.S. Army lost and the local volunteers lost. And in that case, there was a deliberate effort to suppress what happened. And the memoirs about that battle were written 40 years later when the participants were romanticizing their experiences, and they painted it as a victory. In this case, the Battle of Big Bend, the U.S. Army won the battle, and there was no hesitation to trumpet their achievements. And in contrast to the zero reports for the defeat at Battle of Hungry Hill, U.S. Army officers wrote 17,000 words at least describing in detail their great victory at the Battle of Big Bend. So you're right, you have to do some careful source criticism there. But there's a very stark contrast between the romanticization of the Battle of Hungry Hill and a more accurate view of what happened at the Battle of Big Bend.
So I imagine that the circumstances of the battle are well known, like where each side came from and the movements and all of that.
Yes, and that was some of what Jeff Applin really figured out. We had a sketch of it, but he used that systematic archaeological survey to trace out the movement of the battle over the course of it, and we could see the actual ridge lines that each side defended and shot from, and we were able to track the movement of different forces by the presence of fired musket balls and fired what are called canister shot, basically small cannonballs.
The Army actually did come out there quite a bit better equipped, it sounds like, than the Native Americans.
In some ways, the Army had a particular gun, a short-barreled musketoon that was supposed to be useful to fire from horseback, but had a very limited range. And the Native American forces at Takelma and Shasta, they actually had better muskets that could shoot over 150 yards. And for a while in the Battle of Big Bend, the commanding officer, Captain Smith, was actually surrounded and in danger of losing the battle. And that was because his weapons couldn't reach as far as the Native American weapons could.
And in a sense, he was bailed out by reinforcements arriving, wasn't he?
Yeah, just in the nick of time, as they say. And one of his colleagues, Captain Auger, came to reinforce him and broke the siege, basically, and it ended in a big victory. It was pretty dire for him for a while. Captain Smith was the commander of Fort Lane over by Table Rocks. And he was this is one of the things we've learned about this battle, is that some of it was personal. Some of the Native American leaders, like Chief John, had a grudge against him, and they had him surrounded and in dire straits there for a minute, and they actually hung nooses in the trees and taunted them with those nooses and said that these are for you tomorrow morning, and taunted them. The wounded were crying out because they were thirsty and they had no water, and there was a lot of shouting back and forth. At one point, they even hung a dead body, a dead soldier, in one of the nooses to taunt the soldiers.
Wow. So a lot of stuff went on there. The casualty list, as I understand it, is incomplete, at least on one side of the Battle of Big Bend.
Yeah, that's right. There were the U.S. Army suffered about 15% casualties. There was about 200 guys in the battle, and they lost about 30 men. And we don't know the losses suffered by the Native Americans at that point.
Do we even know the size of the force of Takelma and Shasta warriors?
By a rough estimate, it's about 300. So they're about twice as many, or a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened after the battle to the Takelma and Shasta once I imagine a surrender was effected?
Yes. So that was basically, Before the battle started, the indigenous leaders, Chief John, and there was a couple of others, Chief George and Chief Limpy, were basically in a debate about whether or not they should surrender and go to the Grand Ronde and Siletz reservations like some of their cousins had. And some of them, and particularly Chief John, argued against that, and they were arguing for a compromise. And then in the end, they decided to fight it out. But the battle kind of made the deal done, and they surrendered. And most of them went to the Siletz and Grand Ronde reservations shortly thereafter.
All right, so the march off to reservations and out of the Rogue Valley essentially forever from that point.
That's right.
Mark Tvaskov, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, our partner on Underground History, where we look at things that have been discovered about the history of the region and other regions as well by digging in the earth. He's the director of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology on sabbatical in Connecticut right now. You can join our discussion about the Battle of Big Bend and what's been found there, particularly in the Summers dig that Mark led. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, obviously, 161 years since the activities of the Battle of Big Bend. How picked over has the site been from previous visits, official and not?
Oh, that's a great question. Once again, the comparison to the Hungry Hill battlefield is instructive because that was one where the location was, we didn't know where it was until we figured it out. So there were greater amounts of artifacts per unit of area. The Battle of Big Bend is known locally and by metal detectorists and hobbyists. And anecdotally, we know that people have been there and have found lots and lots of things. And we got a sense from our work that we were finding less artifacts than we should have, given the number of people that were there and the action that was there. So that's an example where avocational collectors have had a very real impact on the archaeological site.
Well, I mean, you figure 500 people shooting weapons at each other for a couple of days. Yeah, there should be a fair amount of metal to be found on the ground, and there was from the sounds of it. You did get a grant, Mark, for this year's work. To do what specifically?
Well, this was a grant from the National Park Service Battlefield Protection Program, and it was a grant that allowed us to go out and explore some of these underexplored areas relating specifically to the Rogue River War, and then nominate all these sites to the National Register of Historic Places to honor their place in Oregon's history and the nation's history.
So is the nomination of this site assured?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And what's fortunate about this, it's in a beautiful, undisturbed location, and you know, it's not like it's going to be destroyed by a shopping mall or something, and this will help the Forest Service manage it in that way.
You know, you mentioned metal detectorists coming out there in the past, but it sounds like, as remote as it is, they'd have to be a fairly hardy bunch to want to travel that far. Did that in some ways protect the things that could be found there and were?
Well, as you say, the people that metal detect are a hardy bunch and determined. I mean, they still metal detect at Fort Lane to this day. So I think they would regard it as a challenge, and that's what led them out there.
All right, so what did you find on the dig this summer?
We found, like I said, shot musket balls, like ones that had been fired, which give us a clue to where people were being fired at, like on charging up the slope at the defended position. We found percussion caps, which are like the little gunpowder-filled caps from the old muskets. We found a ramrod from a flintlock pistol, which was an older model that was there. And we also found what are called canister shot, which are these small one-inch iron balls that would have gone into the howitzer or cannon that the soldiers brought that they describe firing at the indigenous people. And once again, that gives us a clue as to where that cannon was positioned on the battlefield and in what direction it was shooting.
So it really is almost like police work in the sense of like they were standing here and shot in that direction. And we can tell
by
the way the slug
fell. Forensic analysis, basically. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, this was brought to archaeology by the work of an archaeologist named Douglas Scott at the Battle of Little Bighorn, and he did that in the 1980s, and that's inspired much work across the country on what's called battlefield archaeology, this forensic analysis like this.
All right, so obviously a lot of metal still to be found out there or has been found out there. You referenced human remains in your prior report before the dig actually started. Have any been found out there ever?
No, not to my knowledge. And we do know that some of the soldiers that were killed in the battle were buried somewhere nearby, but there's conflicting information of where that is. There is a little pioneer cemetery that we located with the help of some locals down there that has some more recent gravestones. And some scholars believe that that was where the soldiers were buried, but the primary documents are conflicting about that location. But somewhere out there, their soldiers are buried for sure, and presumably the Native American dead as well.
Is there ever an effort to locate human remains just for themselves? I mean, if you find them in the way of your work, they're dealt with respectfully, I know. But, I mean, do you ever just go looking specifically for human remains?
No. No, then that's too loaded. I mean, we're not grave robbers, and we want to respect the dead. That's not our intent. The only time that we deal with Native Americans is in a rescue scenario or, as you say, like in a way to protect them. So if there were, for example, some development slated for that area, we would make an effort to think really hard about where they might be so they wouldn't be disturbed.
And did the tribe sign off on the work that was done at the Big Bend battle site this summer?
Yes, they are partners with SULA on the American Battlefield Protection Grant. I mean, this is a joint effort to nominate these sites to the National Register.
And where do the artifacts go then, the stuff that you found out there this summer? What is done with that?
They are curated at Southern Oregon University. They will be kept there in a professionally curated storage facility for future research.
Are they ever brought out to the public for any sort of display?
Well, that's a great question, and someday we hope to get there. SULA's been doing a lot of work at these sites now for a number of years, and I think when it all is said and done, we have the makings of a really good museum exhibit about the Rogue River Wars generally, and that would be something that's probably in the near-distant future.
You've certainly picked up a lot of stuff out there from the Battle of Hungry Heel and now the Battle of Big Bend as well. I want to point out, too, that we referenced your sabbatical. I did see one of the pictures on the Facebook page for SULA that you got a going-away cake with a representation of Miner's Fort on it.
Yeah, that's right. My colleagues, Katie and Chelsea, and the rest at SULA gave me a nice cake, and we had a nice day on the river. I hear you guys are covered with smoke now, though.
We had been for a couple days. It's a little better now for the moment, but it's likely to come back. But you're happy being in Connecticut for now, I'm sure.
Yes.
All right. Mark Tveskov, always a pleasure to talk to you on sabbatical now from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, where he's the director of SULA. And this is our Underground History segment, back next month with Chelsea Rose from SULA. Mark, take care.